Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The United States has less than 5% of the global population, but almost 25% of the prison population. 2.2 million people are currently behind bars. That is a 500% increase over the last 40 years. A 500% increase over the last 40 years. Sentencing policies, implicit racial bias, and socioeconomic inequity contribute to racial disparities at every level of the criminal justice system, according to the Sentencing Project. People of color make up 37% of the population, but 67% of the prison population. The Sentencing Project says changes in law and policy, not changes in crime rates, explain most of this increase. On today's Your Call, we continue our month-long series on solutions by talking about real criminal justice reforms. At the end of the year, Donald Trump signed the First Step Act, a bipartisan criminal justice reform bill. It affects the federal system, which has about 181,000 people behind bars. The act makes a variety of changes, including easing sentencing laws and offering incentives for participating in educational programs. Activists say this is just a start. So joining us to talk about this bill and other needed reforms is Topeka Sam, founder and executive director of the Ladies of Hope Ministries, which helps disenfranchised and marginalized women and girls transition back into society. Topeka is co-founder of Hope House NYC, a safe housing space for women and girls. She's also the first formerly incarcerated person on the board of the Marshall Project. When she was in federal prison, Topeka witnessed firsthand the epidemic and disparity of incarceration on women, but most specifically, women of color. Hi, Topeka. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Molly Gill, a lawyer, advocate, and expert on sentencing law and policy. Molly is vice president of policy for Families Against Mandatory Minimums, a nonpartisan sentencing reform organization in Washington, D.C. Hi, Molly. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you. Topeka, I want to start off with you. I mean, you have firsthand experience with mass incarceration and the whole system. We're talking about a system that costs $182 billion every year. There are a lot of interests here involved in this. And there are so many racial disparities, class disparities. Chances are, if you've got money and connections, you're probably not going to go to jail, depending on what you did. So I want to ask you kind of a big question in the beginning. Given all that you know about this system, what aspect of it would you like to change? What, in your mind, should change?
Well, that's a big question. I would say all of it. But specifically, I would like to, and I've worked to end the criminalization and incarcerate women and girls. Mm-hmm. So I would like to see women who are incarcerated having the opportunity to have alternatives to incarceration. I would like to see people being prepared on the outside opposed to inside to end poverty. I would like to see resources put back into communities instead of building new prisons or trying to enhance prisons. I would like to see sentence reform happen more broadly, looking at maybe re-implementing federal parole so we can end life sentences. I mean, I can keep going.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's a big question, but, you know, we're talking about solutions, and in some ways I want us to really dream big and talk about what really needs to happen to reform this system, because we get piecemeal solutions. And I'm so glad you started with women. Last year we did a week-long series on prisons, and we talk a lot about the overall rate of prisoners coming down, but the rate of women in prisons has far surpassed the growth of male prisoners. The number of women behind bars was about 8 times higher in 2016 than 1980, and the rise is due to these so-called tough-on-crime laws, stiffer drug sentencing laws, and poverty. So it's really shocking to learn that the number of women in prison is actually on the rise.
It isn't, and it isn't, right? Because when you, as you said, you know, men were incarcerated first, and then you leave women home with children and families, lack of resources, still in areas stricken of poverty, and then women are faced with, you know, being criminalized for addiction and, you know, sexual trauma and violence, not understanding that there are resources out there, and sometimes they don't even hit our communities, which is how I began getting really involved in working with Cut 50 through Dignity for Incarcerated Women to make sure that, you know, while we're looking at decarcerating and we want to make sure that women have other opportunities, we also, because the rate of women have grown so high in prison, that we are making sure that the conditions of confinement are more humane with inside the prisons while we wait to bring our sisters home. So that entails ending the shackling of women during child labor, making sure women have proper hygiene products like pads and tampons, making sure that children are within a certain proximity to families to try to keep them unified, if that is even at all possible while we have been incarcerated, avoiding or abolishing having men in male guards in areas where women are undressed, because as I stated, 85% of reported women who go to prison are survivors of sexual violence and abuse, and having a foreign male viewing you while you're trying to change your clothes is re-traumatizing. I mean, just talking about it has me a little bit uneasy. I'm just remembering that experience. And so, you know, through legislation that we've been able to pass, thank God, 8 pieces around the country, and we're looking to pass 8 more this year. Women who are formerly incarcerated are leading the efforts with the support and leadership of Cut 50 to make sure that dignity for women inside prisons are more humane.
Wow. That's Topeka Sam. She's founder and executive director of the Ladies of Hope Ministries, which helps disenfranchised and marginalized women and girls transition back into society. Molly Gill is a lawyer, advocate, and expert on sentencing law and policy. Same big question to you, Molly. When you think about truly reforming this system, what is at the top of your list?
Well, at the very top of my list, if we want to reduce the prison population in America, is changing sentencing laws. That is the number one priority. America punishes people much more harshly than any other nation on earth, and we send people away for life for things that other countries, people would get 20 years or 30 years or much more reasonable period of time. We lead the world in people incarcerated for life. So we do need to abolish life without parole sentencing and do serious reforms to life without parole sentencing. We need to get rid of mandatory minimum sentencing and stop forcing judges to send people to prison even if they don't need to be there, or sending them there much longer than they need to be there. We need to take a serious look at things like parole reform and making sure that parole boards are actually letting people out. That's a major problem in this country, is that even in states where parole is available, and it is not available in the federal system at all, we have a lot of parole boards that just simply do not release people. They're still looking at what that person did, and they're not looking at how the person changed, and they're keeping people in for far, far longer than is necessary. We need to think more about alternatives to incarceration and give judges more options at sentencing instead of just prison. And we've done this with the vast expansion of drug treatment courts and mental health treatment courts, and increasingly we're using veterans courts that keep people out of prison and keep them in the community and connect them with the services that will actually solve the problems that led to their crimes in the first place. And that is a good development, but we still limit dramatically who can participate in those programs. And we do very little sentencing reform, or I should rather say no sentencing reform at all, for people convicted of violent offenses. And, in the last 30 years, more than 35 states have reformed their mandatory minimum drug sentencing laws. And it's time that for us to start really looking at some of the more serious offenses. And I think starting with the simple conversation of what is and is not a violent offense, looking at things like in some states a burglary is a violent offense. Is that always a violent offense? Is there something that we can do to make the sentencing more flexible so you can really sort out people with serious violent histories from people who this is their first violent offense, and not to, you know, not to minimize the seriousness of violent offenses, but we have to stop treating everybody like they're the same, and we have to stop sort of sorting people into good and bad categories and start really thinking about these people as neighbors who are almost all coming home someday, and we want to bring them home better than they went to prison. We want to fix the thing that led to their crime in the first place, and we want to bring them home so they can still have a family, still be able to enter the job force, still compete in the job market. And when I talk about sentence length, I think that people forget the importance of time itself and punishment. When you keep someone in prison for 10 years instead of 5, that's 5 years of the job market that they're missing out on. That's 5 years of changes in technology that they're missing out on. That's 5 years that they're not at home caring for their kids, developing a relationship with their young children, being a partner to their spouse, paying taxes. You're hindering their future economic mobility. So we really do need to think very, very hard and very seriously about who are we putting in prison, how long are we keeping them there, and then what are we doing while they're in there to bring them home and be good neighbors to us.
And since you brought up life without parole, Molly, the ACLU has a report out identifying 3,200 people in 9 states and the federal system who are serving life without parole. 4 out of 5 are Black or Latino, all come from poor backgrounds. And according to Jennifer Turner, ACLU human rights researcher and author of this report, we're talking about people who had possession of a crack pipe, acting as a middleman in the sale of $10 of marijuana, possession of a bottle cap containing a trace amount of heroin, selling a single crack rock, shoplifting a $159 jacket. I think it's really important to talk about specifics. Because, again, we're talking about people who are serving life without parole.
Yeah. But a lot of these, a lot of people end up getting life without parole because of habitual offender laws and enhancements. You know, they have multiple prior convictions, and then they get this very long sentence because they're considered career criminals or repeat offenders. And you're right. The problem with those laws is that they lack proportionality. They're not looking at what did this person do now, today, to get this, what was the crime they committed today to get this punishment. And there have been some reforms to repeat offender laws, but not enough. And the problem with giving people very long sentences, even as they're repeat offenders, is that people age out of crime. Crime is a young man's game, and it's all downhill after 35. So, you know, people are not committing the same number of crimes or the same level of crimes at 50 as they are at 25. And certainly the older people get, the lower and lower their recidivism rates get and their likelihood of reoffending gets. And so what you have in this country is you have a problem of a lot of states and the federal government having an increasingly old and increasingly ill prison population on their hands. And that means that those people are very expensive to care for. They have increased medical needs, medication needs, health care needs. You have to sometimes refurbish your prisons to look like nursing homes so that they can get around. You have people in wheelchairs, walkers. These people are not public safety threats anymore. They are very expensive to incarcerate, and we're getting almost no public safety return on our dollar for incarcerating them. And really what puts people there are some of these, again, sort of just laws that sound like good ideas if you're a politician stumping on the campaign trail, and in reality aren't much of a service to the communities you're trying to protect.
Molly Gill is Vice President of Policy for Families Against Mandatory Minimums, a nonprofit sentencing reform organization in Washington. And now I would like to welcome Jessica Jackson to the show. Jessica is a human rights attorney who began her career representing men and women on California's death row and their appeals. She's also National Director and co-founder of Cut 50, an organization dedicated to identifying solutions to crime that reduce the prison population. And Jessica became aware of prison policies after her former husband went to prison for a nonviolent crime. Hi, Jessica. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
We're going to talk about the First Step Act in just a minute, but I also wanted to ask you the big question I asked Topeka and Molly. When you think about truly reforming this system, what is at the top of your list? What would you like to change?
Well, I think for me, the biggest reform that we can make is in the form of changing the narrative around criminal justice. There is so much stigma and so much embarrassment. I got to tell you, when I was 22 years old and I was standing in the courtroom holding my two-month-old daughter, watching my husband go to prison, I was so embarrassed and so ashamed and so isolated. I didn't tell anybody what was going on. I had to kind of struggle through that hardship financially, emotionally, because people would have judged me, and I didn't even put it on my law school application. I was afraid they weren't even going to let me in. And that's just as the partner of somebody who's going into prison. People who have been in prison or in the criminal justice system are stigmatized every single day, and they're treated like they're lesser human beings because they made a bad decision. They're treated as though they can't grow and change and come out and be successful and contribute to society. And we see this playing out over and over again. It's why there are so many collateral consequences for a conviction, right? It's hard to get a job. It's hard to get a loan from a bank. It's hard to find housing. It's hard to move forward with your life from that bad decision. So I think the biggest change we can have is changing fundamentally how we as a society view people who have been system involved and how we give them second chances.
Topeka, what would you add to that? Because when you were in federal prison, you saw firsthand the epidemic and disparity of the incarceration of women. So what do you think about the narrative around this and how it needs to change?
I think that Jessica hit the nail on the head. The fact that, to add to what she said, you know, those of us who are coming home and, you know, all the barriers that we suffer, whether it is for housing, safe housing, whether it is for employment, whether it's trying to get back to school, it's all of these, you know, boxes that you have to check, and people have to be put in these different places, and then you have to continue to relive this trauma over and again and explain what you may have done. For me at the time, it was 3 years prior to me. I was incarcerated for 3 years, so it was 3 years before. For many people, it could have been 10 years or even 20 years prior. And I just had a conversation with someone yesterday who still is having difficulty finding a safe place to live after 20 years, wanting to just move in a better community, and had to go through, check the box on a housing application for an apartment, and they wouldn't allow her to live there because of her criminal conviction, which was over 20 years ago. And she even offered to pay, you know, extra security deposit, pay the rent up for 6 months, and they told her no. Had stable employment for the last 10 years, and they still told her no. So, you know, these frustrations and what people think within the communities, you know, within this country about people who have been impacted and not understanding the numbers are growing because it's actually impacting each and every one of us, and that we need to begin to understand what's really happening in this country so we can change it.
Topeka Sam is founder and executive director of the Ladies of Hope Ministries, which helps disenfranchised and marginalized women and girls transition back into society. Molly Gill is vice president of policy for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. And Jessica Jackson is national director and co-founder of Cut 50, an organization dedicated to identifying solutions to crime that reduce the prison population. And today we are talking about what it will take to truly reform this system. We do have the First Step Act, which was just signed into law. Activists say it's a good start, but so much more needs to be done. I mean, we are talking about a $182 billion system. That's what it costs every year to incarcerate 2.2 million people in this country. If you have any personal experience with the system and you'd like to share your experience, what are your thoughts about true reform? What's at the top of your list? If you have been following this First Step Act, we'd also love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. So I'm so glad that we started by talking about the big ideas and the big changes that need to happen. Let's spend a little time talking about this First Step Act. It was a bipartisan bill. It was signed at the end of the year. The Marshall Project says this could impact about 2,000 inmates. And you were talking, Molly, about sentencing reform. One aspect of this is mandatory minimum sentencing. According to a summary from Vox, the bill will ease the three strikes rule so that people with three or more convictions, including drug offenses, they automatically get 25 years instead of life. I mean, it's amazing that you can get life for a drug offense, but that's where we are. So what are your thoughts about the changes to minimum sentencing in this First Step Act?
Well, I think I would describe the sentencing reforms as sort of fixing the worst of the worst aspects of our federal drug sentencing laws. They certainly are not all that we need to do. They are not the reforms don't do as much as states are doing. For example, Louisiana just repealed all of its mandatory minimum sentencing laws. And the state there is reducing its prison population and its prison costs, and crime is going down, and it's been a real success story, and I think will continue to be one. So that gives you a sense of how modest these reforms are. In the federal prison system, the federal system is one of the only ones in the country where you can get a mandatory life without parole sentence for drug offenses. And your prior convictions don't have to be violent offenses. They are drug offenses. So once you commit that third drug offense, you can get a life without parole sentence and die in federal prison. And this bill now says that you only go to federal prison for 25 years as opposed to life. The downside to that reform is that it's not retroactive, so it does not help anybody who's already in prison serving life without parole for a third drug offense, which was a major shortcoming of the bill. And I think points to the need for President Trump to hear clemency petitions and let some of these people who got left behind, let them out, notice their rehabilitation and the fact that they've been in prison a long time, and let them go back home to their families and say that they've done enough time. There were several other important fixes. One of them is the expansion of one of the only exceptions to federal mandatory minimum drug sentencing, which is called the safety valve. And that exception applies to low-level nonviolent offenders with minimal criminal history and allows the judge to give you something below the mandatory minimum. So, for example, you could get 8 years instead of the 10-year mandatory minimum if you meet all the criteria. And that safety valve, the criteria were expanded, and so now we think that another 2,000 people every year facing these federal mandatory drug penalties will be eligible for the safety valve and could get a sentence that's more reasonable based on their role and what they actually did in the offense.
And we have just about 30 seconds before we go to break. I just want to ask you quickly, how did activists in Louisiana push politicians to pass such major sentencing reform laws?
I think there were a combination of factors in Louisiana, and one of them that the federal government doesn't face is budget pressure. The federal government can print money and obviously have a shutdown if you can't agree on fiscal spending. States don't have those options, and they have to balance their budgets and make really tough choices between, do we want to pay for more schools or fix potholes or build hospitals, or do we want to pay for prisons? And Louisiana had a real prison crisis on its hands, and they decided, you know what, we want to spend money on schools and potholes and hospitals rather than prisons, and that was a major factor there. There was a bipartisan coalition that worked on that. This is a bipartisan issue where you will find people who don't agree about anything else agreeing that we're safer if we are actually smarter about who we put in prison and how long we keep them there. And that's what happened in Louisiana.
Wow, we should do a show about that. Molly Gill is Vice President of Policy for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Today we're talking about true reforms to this criminal justice system. We're also joined by Topeka Sam, Executive Director of the Ladies of Hope Ministries, and Jessica Jackson, co-founder of Cut 50. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will talk about media coverage of the government shutdown with a specific focus on contract workers and workers who struggle to make ends meet. The federal government is the largest employer of low-wage workers. 4.5 million contractor jobs pay less than $15 an hour. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. We'll also talk about what's going to happen to the 38 million people who rely on food stamps in the United States. If you would like to listen to past shows or podcast our show, you can visit yourcallradio.org. This week, we talked about solutions regarding universal health care, the Green New Deal, and how to get money out of politics. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about how to truly reform the criminal justice system. We've got 2.2 million people behind bars. Mass incarceration costs $182 billion every year. So if you have anything to add in terms of changes you'd like to see, if you have a personal story to share, if you'd like to ask any question about this First Step Act, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Molly Gill is Vice President of Policy for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Topeka Sam is Executive Director of the Ladies of Hope Ministries, which helps disenfranchised and marginalized women and girls transition back into society. When Topeka was in federal prison, she saw firsthand the epidemic and disparity specifically of women of color in prison. And Jessica Jackson is co-founder of Cut 50. They are dedicated to identifying solutions to crime that reduce the prison population. And she first became aware of policies after her former husband went to prison for a nonviolent crime. Jessica, we were talking about some of the changes in sentencing reform with Molly in the First Step Act. What are your thoughts about this, specifically the sentencing reforms in that bill?
Yeah. First, I just want to correct something that was said earlier. I think you said that the bill only affected 2,000 people, and the majority of the bill on the prison reform side actually impacts 186,000 people who are in the prisons, the dignity portions, the programming, all of that. There's a little piece of time credits over on the prison reform piece that only impacts about half the folks inside. On the sentencing reform side, we actually should be seeing a lot more relief. There's the Fair Sentencing Act becoming retroactive. That was the law that ended the racist, disparate crack cocaine laws. So that's going to be applied retroactively. We've already seen at least one person come home, Matthew Charles, come home under that, and we expect about 2,600 to 3,000 more people. There's also a fix in there around the good time credit that people can earn. Now they'll be able to get an extra 7 days per year of good time credit, and we were able to get that applied retroactively. So that's going to impact about 4,000 people who should be coming home, hopefully very soon, under the retroactive good time credit. And then there's the sentencing reform. And I think, you know, like the title of the bill, it's a first step. It's certainly not everything. We need to address the roles of conspiracy. We need to address mandatory minimums, as Molly said. It's not everything, but it was a first step. And I think the best thing about this bill is, again, the narrative change. The fact that we were able to see the left and the right come together, and not by a small margin, pass sentencing and prison reform and have it signed into law by Donald Trump, the president who campaigned on American carnage and who now is recognizing that our current justice system isn't fair.
You brought up a number of points there. You talked about the good time credit. Can you explain this system and how it works?
Yes. So the good time credit, there are two different kinds of credit inside of the bill. There's the good time credit, which is for people who are showing good behavior inside the prisons. There's the time credit. The time credit is tied to the programming. So it's an incentive to get people to participate in life-changing classes while they're inside. Now, it's not something that we just thought up in the federal bill. It's actually something that's working very well in state prisons across the country. As Molly said earlier, you know, the goal of our prisons should be to fix the underlying reason why people are committing crimes in the first place. So now when they come into the federal prison, they're going to have a risk and needs assessment that will match them with the kind of programming they need. And there's a substantial investment in expanding the programming in the First Step Act. Once they get matched with that programming, if they participate in the programming, you know, anger management, educational programming, parenting classes, addiction classes, that type of thing, they will then be able to get time credits that reduce the amount of time they have to spend inside of the prison.
The bill authorizes $250 million over 5 years for the development and the expansion of some of these programs and these training programs.
Yes, yes. So okay. that's a substantial investment. And then it also allows for volunteers to come in the prison. And I think Topeka can also speak to how important this is. When there are volunteers coming into the prison, it not only opens up the ability to have more programming, but it also increases transparency in the prisons, and it allows people who are coming in, especially if it's formerly incarcerated people who know what it's like to come home and reenter society, it allows them to serve as mentors and to begin to build their network. So when people are coming home, they'll have folks they can reach out to on the outside who are familiar with them, who know them from their work inside, and who can help them get back on their feet.
Topeka, can you jump in there?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Jessica knows. Well, we definitely are really excited about that provision, specifically as we're going into the prisons ourselves now just to, you know, offer support. But now it'll allow us to actually develop programs and bring the programs that we're developed on the outside inside the prisons, because Jessica said it again, right? You know, we know firsthand what we need. A lot of times the programs that come into the prison, which are helpful because, you know, let's face it, you have nothing to do. So when you have someone from the outside coming, giving of their time, we appreciate it. However, a lot of the programs don't reach us for when we get outside, giving us skills that we need, helping us transition, letting us know what to expect. And unfortunately, being formally incarcerated, a lot of times they do not allow us to come in because either we've been in that prison before and they don't want us to come in, or it's just this fear, again, based on the stigma that once you've been incarcerated, once you've been convicted of a crime, there's really no redemption. And so this is really one of, if not the most exciting for formerly incarcerated people, because it really gives us an opportunity to create things that will help our sisters and brothers.
And Topeka, we were talking about the time credit system. According to Vox, as many as 4,000 people could qualify for release the day that the bill goes into effect, because the individuals can earn 54 days of good time credits a year, a change from the previously allowed 47 days per year. How significant is this?
I mean, it's very, very significant. Look, you know, I remember being inside, a day is a day is a day. When the All Drugs Minus Two law passed, I found out I was getting 18 months off my sentence. I had no idea. And so I took the drug program. I ended up getting a year off, and then I was supposed to get 6 months off for mandatory, halfway house, and then the law passed. And I get a call in, and I'm told I'm leaving in 2 weeks. So, you know, just to know that the thousands of people are going to have the same opportunity, and as Jessica said, Matthew is already home, just working so hard, advocating so hard, and looking to see how we can begin to use this as model legislation to then go from state to state. Because we do know that, yes, this has impacted the federal system, but then we also have state systems all over this country that also need some serious change.
Let's talk a little bit about Matthew Charles. He was sentenced to 35 years in prison on charges that he trafficked crack cocaine in 1996. In 2015, a federal judge agreed that he deserved a shortened sentence. He was released in 2016 and didn't reoffend, but an appeals court reversed the judge's ruling, and he was ordered to serve 35 years behind bars. But this First Step Act cleared the way for Matthew Charles' sentence to be reconsidered again, and his sentence was reduced to time served. I mean, everybody has a story. Can you talk about, do you want to take this one first, Jessica? I mean, this is one story of so many.
Yeah, and Matthew Charles is just such an inspirational story. I've even seen some of the comments he's making when he's coming home. He's saying how he refuses to be bitter and angry. But his was a case that we pointed to while we were meeting with legislators and talking about the First Step Act. His attorney, Sean Hopwood, was actually one of the central figures to making sure that the First Step Act passed, and was standing there in the Oval Office with Topeka and I right when the president signed it into law and reached over, gave us a big bear hug, which you've seen in some of the footage. But Matthew Charles is just absolutely amazing. There was no reason for him to be sent back to prison. It was obvious when he came home. He was able to get his life on track. He was working. He had housing. And then suddenly he gets ripped out of his community and sent back to prison for not even committing a new crime, for no reason. So we're really glad to see him come home. We're glad he was the first person to come home, and we're looking to seeing a lot more people coming home as well.
Molly, you have to wonder how many other cases like Matthew Charles are out there. How many other people are behind bars in a similar situation?
Yeah, well, we know there are at least 2,600 people who could benefit from the same change that he benefited from, which is making those crack law changes retroactive. And we'll see over time as those people start getting their motions filed in court and getting their sentences reduced, we'll start seeing more people come home. And I think the Matthew Charles case is so powerful because we got a chance to see how he was going to do on the outside. He was home for 2 years. He was in a committed relationship. He was volunteering in his community, attending church. And we got to see him, too, physically. He is a gentle, sweet man. He is, not a young man anymore. He's grown up. He's an older, wiser man now. And we have gotten to see physically those changes. And I think that's so important in letting people know that people change while they're in prison. The people who are going to come home under this bill, they're people who have done a lot of time. They're people who've been away a long time. But a lot of them are also people who've worked really hard while they've been in prison to stay positive, to get an education, to do every class that they could, to get any job training available to them, and who have in some cases fought really hard to keep those relationships with families alive too. So I think we're in for just a lot more heartwarming stories, stories of redemption, stories of second chances, and we need to see that as a country if we're going to keep doing criminal justice reform.
Molly Gill is Vice President of Policies for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Jessica Jackson is co-founder of Cut 50, an organization dedicated to identifying solutions to crime that reduce the prison population. She became aware of prison policies after her former husband went to prison for a nonviolent crime. And Topeka Sam is founder and executive director of the Ladies of Hope Ministries, which helps disenfranchised and marginalized women and girls transition back into society. She's co-founder of Hope House NYC, a safe housing space for women and girls. And she saw firsthand, when she was in federal prison, the epidemic and disparity of the incarceration of women, especially women of color. And if you have any thoughts about, the best ways to reform the system, if you have firsthand experience, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. When we began the show, Topeka, you were talking about the changes you would like to see that would specifically affect women. And it's always shocking when you see stories about how pregnant women are shackled behind bars. The First Step Act bans the shackling of pregnant women and extends these protections to 3 months after pregnancy. Can you talk about how significant this is? And does this apply across the country? Are we talking about federal prisons, just federal prisons here?
Yes, we're just talking about federal prisons through this legislation.
Okay.
Just to touch on what you said about women and how important this ending of shackling is for women. So Pamela Nguyen, who was held in Georgia in federal prison, she actually was handcuffed and shackled when she was pregnant. She tripped and fell, was put in solitary confinement, and she lost her baby. She was a registered nurse, knew a lot, had a lot of medical experience, kept telling them that she was, you know, having severe pains and that she knew there was a problem. She goes to the hospital finally, and they act them where the fetus was, and they pulled, and she tells this story on the website dignityact.org, but that they drew the baby away, right? And you know, this is happening in prisons all over the country, and yes, this has ended shackling in federal prison. But what we do, as I mentioned earlier, I'm also the director for the Dignity for Incarcerated Women campaign for Cut 50. And what we do is end the shackling and change legislation for women around the country in states. And so we have already passed 8 pieces of legislation to end shackling. We are also looking at 8 more states this year. And people can learn more by just going to our website, again, dignityact.org, to specifically look at what we have done and what we're planning to do and how they can get involved. Because this is happening, I believe, and now with 33 states with the passive legislation, over 25 states still in this country still shackling women during child labor, putting women in solitary confinement. And even the states that actually have banned it, like New York, just recently a woman was shackled again in New York. So, you know, that also leads to having to have oversight. When the laws are passed, we have to make sure that there's oversight, that there's proper implementation, and that people are held accountable. So, you know, we're out here working every single day, making sure that we have the things that we need, both as it relates to resources, opportunity, access, but also that these conditions are more humane for people while they're incarcerated.
Topeka, why are women shackled to begin with?
I mean, that's the question that all of us have. You know, for women who've had children, there's no threat for a woman who is pregnant, right? Like, where's a woman running? And then when during child labor, under epidural or any other medication that she's under, she can't move. So where would she run, right? And I think this is another tactic to dehumanize women. And, you know, when you think about alternatives to incarceration, you know, my thing is, if a woman is pregnant going into prison, and women who are noticeably in their second trimester sometimes, if a woman is engaged in some type of activity that's landing her in prison, the bigger issue is not locking up the woman. The issue is what happened, right? Because a woman is going to do things to protect herself and her child. So, you know, it's really looking at the root of these problems. And then, you know, what I have not really heard about much was us talking about even the conspiracy laws, you know, and the fact that women are put into prison disproportionately and at the alarming rate because of these conspiracy laws. And, you know, I really I want to lend Jessica some time and opportunity to talk more to that and some of the work that's going to be continuing to be done around that as well.
Jessica, what are conspiracy laws?
Yeah, so the conspiracy laws, unfortunately, as Topeka was saying, is a way that a lot of people who have a very small role in a bigger conspiracy get caught up into the system, because essentially you're responsible for all of the crimes that are committed within the scope of that conspiracy. So if I play a small role like picking up money from a bank robbery. If somebody got killed in that bank robbery, I'm going to be liable as well for that death because I'm liable for all of the crimes committed throughout the conspiracy. So there's been a lot of thought around the idea of creating weighted roles in conspiracy, looking at individuals' intent, looking at what they intended to be the outcome, what their role was, and instead of making everybody liable for all of the crimes, actually kind of individualizing it. And making them liable for the crimes that they did take part in.
The other aspect of the First Step Act and how it affects women is it requires the Bureau of Prisons to provide sanitary napkins and tampons to incarcerated women at no cost. I mean, this is getting a lot more attention, and Topeka, this is very significant.
Thank you. It was really, really important to me to join forces with Cup 50 and Jessica on this specifically because of my own experience as related to the need for extra sanitary napkins because of my medical condition at the time with uterine fibroids. And I understand how I was just humiliated and how I was treated. And last year, we had went into the White House for a White House prison summit, and I expressed during that time how I was asked to quantify my cycle, which meant I had to take the used pads, put them in a brown paper bag, and show them to the male officer that was on duty in order for them to issue me some new pads. And so it was, right. I mean, I can wow. give you 2 minutes to let it sit, but it was so humiliating. It was so, I think about it and my skin cringes still of what they made me do and the fact that I had resources, I had family support. I was still able to get, buy sanitary napkins from commissary. However, there was a limit to that. So no matter what it was that I had to do, I still had to go to the officer and go through that. And then I think about all the other women who did not have the access and resources and what they had to go through, right? Wow. And so my personal experience, led me to really have to relive that trauma over and over again and talk about that so that people really understood. And when I had the opportunity to actually say that in front of the president and the vice president, and at the time, everybody was there. I'm so stuck on just what I had to go through. And when we recently had an opportunity to talk to Jared about, the First Step Act passing before it was about to be signed through the president, and Jared came up to me and said he remembered me speaking specifically about how graphic I was about that and how terrible he felt. And I was like, how terrible do you think I felt? And how terrible do you think all the women feel? And, why he was just so proud to be able to help push this legislation forward. For that reason as well. So, yeah, it's very, very significant.
It's so hard to even fathom, and that's your story. So many other women are dealing with that. The other thing that's really important, we're not going to have time to get into this, but the First Step Act includes a provision that requires the Bureau of Prisons to incarcerate people within 500 driving miles of their families. So many times it's hard for loved ones to see their partners, their moms, their dads who are behind bars. The big question here, Molly, we have just a couple minutes left. How is this all going to be enforced? Because Topeka said that even though it's not legal to shackle women in New York, she knows of a woman who was shackled. So how will this all be enforced? Where's the accountability here?
Congress has oversight committees in both houses, and it's really important that they do oversight, that they haul the Bureau of Prisons officials up in front of them, that they ask them for data about this. The bill, fortunately, has a lot of reporting requirements. The Bureau of Prisons is going to have to send annual data on a lot of these things that we've talked about to the House Judiciary Committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, and between the Judiciary Committees and the Oversight Committees, they're going to have to read those reports, make them available, and then just really call BOP to account. The Bureau of Prisons has long been sort of an unpoliced place, and there are a lot of stories we hear, and we know that those are things that are not supposed to be happening, and yet they're happening. So This bill is going to be an ongoing project. Just because we passed it does not mean it's the end. It is indeed the first step in criminal justice reform, but it's passing. It is also the first step to making sure that these reforms actually happen. You know, on the 500-mile rule, we talk to families every day who spend thousands of dollars to go visit their loved ones. It is very, very hard on families. This is a huge expense for them. It means that they are not buying other things. They are foregoing other family vacations. They are foregoing basic necessities sometimes, like food and paying the electric bill. And they're making really, really hard choices about, do I go see this loved one and bring my kid to this prison, you know, 700 miles away, 800 miles away, or, you know, do I pay the rent this month? And what it means functionally is a lot of kids grow up and spend years without seeing their parents while they're in prison. And that's just a travesty for families. So this new rule will hopefully, with some oversight, force the Bureau of Prisons to keep people close to home. Those family connections make such a difference when those people come back. People who have family connections come back and they reoffend much less than people who don't.
Well, we will definitely continue to focus on this issue, especially as this law is implemented. Molly Gill is Vice President of Policy for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Molly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Jessica Jackson is co-founder of Cut 50, an organization dedicated to identifying solutions to crime that reduce the prison population. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me on.
And Topeka Sam, founder and executive director of the Ladies of Hope Ministries and co-founder of Hope House NYC. Topeka, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And you can find more information about the First Step Act and more in general about criminal justice reform at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will talk about the impacts of the government shutdown on contract workers. The federal government is the largest employer of low-wage workers. 4.5 million contractor jobs pay less than $15 an hour. And as you've heard by now, so many people are having a hard time paying their rent and making ends meet. So we'll talk about media coverage tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.